exciting to get there as a pastor. I've never preached on David Goliath. One of the reasons why I have is because it's intimidating, because everybody knows this story, don't we? I just heard an announcer watching the NBA semifinals, and the announcer was saying something to the effect that the matchup was a David and Goliath matchup, he said. And I was just like, okay, well, that's intimidating. Everybody thinks they know this story, sort of like the Christmas story. How do you preach something, a story that's this well known, that makes it new, makes it fresh? And we're going to see by God's grace if we can't do that together. The story's embedded itself in our language and culture. Like I said, Goliath is in many ways ceased to be a name and started becoming an adjective. It referred to persons or situations or circumstances or experiences, a Goliath this and a Goliath that. And so it's a significant story. It's significant culturally, but very significant biblically, and most importantly, concerning this guy by the name of David. We're going to be introduced to him today. 1 Samuel chapter 17, beginning there in verse 1, it said, "Now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle, and they gathered at Soko, which belongs to Judah, and they camped between Soko and Azekah and Aphis Damim," which means nothing to you. But let's put it to you this way: the Israelites live in the hill country, the Philistines live along the coast, the Gaza Strip, if you're familiar with that in news today. They lived in the same place, and they caused the same kind of problems that the Gaza people cause today with the Israelis. And so halfway between them is kind of an area called the Shephelah. And the Shephelah is an area where you find this happening. And so it's sort of a meeting place between these two countries that never got along with each other. "And Saul and the men of Israel," it says, verse 2, "gathered and camped in the valley of Elah and drew up in battle array and encountered the Philistines. And the Philistines stood on the mountain on one side, while the Israel stood on the mountain on the other side with a valley in between them." And I've been to this place. My wife and I have been there several times. And I looked for a picture of the place, but I couldn't find a picture that didn't have me in it. So I apologize for call me David. I actually have a sling there. Improvised sling by the missionaries that we travel with over there, and thought it would be big fun to sling it. Let me tell you something, it's a good way to hurt yourself really, really bad. You see the size of the rock that I have in my hand, and that's the kind of rock that they would sling up in these things, and they would have a sling about that long. And to be proficient at these things, you had to be practiced. But more than anything, disregard me. What I want you to see is that's the actual valley that I'm standing in there. Behind me is a creek bed. Behind that is a mountain, and you notice the mountain is sort of shaped like a stadium seating. Well, in between that stadium seating and an identical stadium seating about a half a mile away is this huge valley called the Elah Valley. And when I went to Israel for the first time, of course studying the Bible all my life and being a pastor and going to seminary and all this stuff, I had images in my head of what places looked like, what circumstances and situations, what they looked like. And in most cases, I was disappointed, I will say this, because whatever I had of Israel, Israel's very simple, very small. And it's sort of, if you have these grandiose ideas of what it might otherwise be, you'll be disappointed. One place that I was not disappointed, though, was this place. This place looks exactly like it's described in the Scriptures. You basically have a mountain on one side that's slanted, just like you see there, stadium seating. The Israelis would have been on that mountain, that's their side. On the other, in between is about a three-quarter of a mile or half a mile, very flat, almost like a soccer field, just a nice, got a nice slope to it, field in the middle planted today by the Israelis, this nice field, this creek running through it. On the other side is this perfect stadium seating type of mountain. So you have the good guys on the one side, we'll call them the Aggies, all right, the Israelis. And on the other side, you have the devil-worshipping Longhorns. And so that's just to help you get, you know, I know that'll really bring it home for some of you especially. Just help you really, because we want to bring it into context of today, don't we? You have the children of God on one side. You have the Philistines who are irrepressible people, always unconsciously ready to be God's rod of instrument of discipline to the nation of Israel, which they were throughout many ages, especially in the ages of Saul and David. And so we have this situation where they're set up in this field. Like I said, I'm sorry for the no better picture than that, but that's the only one that I could find. The odds, though, don't seem in favor of the good guys. And we keep reading here in verse 4. It says, "Then the champion came out." This is he's the big guy, one of the big guys in every way, a big guy in the story. "Champion came out from the armies of the Philistines named Goliath from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits, only about 8 miles from this spot is where Gath is. Still there today, by the way, is where this from. He was 6 cubits and a span tall. That's a monster. He had a bronze helmet on his head, and he was clothed with scale armor, which weighed 5,000 shekels of bronze. He also had a bronze greaves, basically shin guards. The armor came down to there, and then he had shin guards below that. Bronze javelin slung between his shoulders. This didn't say the size of it, but you can imagine it's probably big. And the shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, about 2-inch pipe. That's how big the shaft of this spear was. And the head of the spear weighing 600 shekels of iron, and he carried, his shield bearer walked in front of him. He stood and shouted at the ranks of Israel. So we got this giant of a dude. And I put a comparison on the screen as best I could. The height that you have there of Goliath works out to roughly 9'9". Here's a comparison between another guy that you think is pretty big, or at least you did. Shaquille O'Neal, he's 7'1". Goliath would have been a full 2 feet higher than him, over 2 feet taller than him. And that's just a comparison. He wouldn't even made it to his shoulder. Of course, an artist's rendition of Goliath, and there's Brother Shaq there. And by the way, I'm 6'2". You want to see what I look like compared to these two guys? Look at that. That's a really good picture I had of myself, too. I think that's how I would have looked had I been there on that day. I'm 6'2". I'm not a short guy. But compared to Shaq, I'm a short guy. Compared to him, oh, my goodness. And so this guy is an absolute monster. The armor he has on, according to the scriptures, weighs around 200 pounds. So just the stuff that he has covered in the front of him and the back of him, 200 pounds. He has a spearhead that weighs 25 pounds on a weaver's beam type of pole. Just as a point of comparison, a shot put weighs 16 pounds in Olympic competition. So this guy is swinging a big stick. He's bad in every way. He's not some skinny basketball player. He's a monster. He's a really, really big dude. Again, the Bible doesn't give us descriptions of much of anybody in the scriptures, but it does give us descriptions of giants like him. There's other ones like him that we see in Israel. When Israel came to invade the promised land, remember when they were delivered from Egypt, they went and they said, referring to some of these giants, we were like grasshoppers in their sight. You can imagine. How many of you ever seen a tall Jew? I've never met one. And so these guys, He just didn't pick people of stature when he picked the children. They're his people, but he didn't pick people of stature in general. They're not very tall people. And so they come in against this guy. So you can imagine the circumstances. And he's not just standing there. He's challenging. We continue there in verse 8. And he stood and shouted at the ranks of Israel. And he said to them, "Why do you come out to draw in battle array? Am I not a Philistine, and you the servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he's able to fight with me and kill me, then we will become your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall become our servants and serve." This was a fairly classic way of doing battle back in that time. Rarely ever worked, but quite often classic way. You've probably seen movies, I think the 500 or whatever, which I don't recommend, but they start off the movie that way, or the 300 or whatever. Thank you, Jeff. Some number. And they start off the movie that way. Bring out your champion, and they bring out their champion, and they fight, and whoever wins, well, of course, that side wins, and the other side loses. And it never really totally worked. No indication that it ever did. But it was at least something that was tried. But who was going to fight this guy? Well, no one was. No one was. He said, "If you're able to fight and kill me, then will you be servants?" And again, it says the Philistine, he says, "I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that he may fight." When Saul and all of Israel heard these words, verse 11, the Philistines, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. It tells us down in verse 16, the Philistine came forward morning and evening for 40 days. 40 days. Like I said, this valley that is, let me get it up there for you, it's about a half a mile wide. So he wasn't like he was just standing over in the other stadium seating, shouting at them. He was coming over on their sidelines. "Challenge me. Take a swing. Take a hit. Take a chance." Twice a day for 40 days. Imagine what that's like. Talk about demoralizing the troops. This would be tough. And by the way, who's the logical choice to fight this guy? Who's the tallest guy in Israel? Saul is. And he's the king. Head and shoulders above everyone in Israel, which, like I said, a point of comparison, I've never met a really tall Jew, so maybe he's 6 foot, maybe 6 foot two. Like I said, maybe he's about my size. you know, maybe he's that tall. Maybe. But he's not dumb enough to go out there. No one is. They're scared to death of him. And, of course, their hearts are not right with God, and the help's going to have to come from someone else. Of course, we know that. And, of course, the help shows up in a place that's very unlikely, and we start reading about him here in verse 17. Here, the nation of Israel is beginning to be introduced to a guy by the name of David, very significant player all the way through scriptures. He becomes the father, ultimately, of the Messiah, who we know is Jesus. And it says, Jesse said to his son David, remember, he's watching the flocks. He's the youngest kid, and so he gets left with the worst jobs. Take now for your brothers an ephah of roasted grain and 10 loaves, and run to the camp of your brothers, and bring also these 10 cuts of cheeses. He sends him with a bunch of food, essentially, and goes down to see his older brothers who are fighting. David, we don't know how old he is, but we do know he's too young to fight. 16, 17, maybe 14, 15, we don't really know. He's a kid, though. He's called that by Saul, and he's called that by others, and his brothers are very disdaining toward him. Look at verse 20. So he arrives. David arose early in the morning, left the flock. Bethlehem, which is where he is about 15 miles as the crow flies to this place where they're having the battle. And so if he walks at 5 miles an hour, he takes about 3.5 hours to get there. He gets there about 9:30 in the morning. So that's when this guy's coming out, lo and behold, coming out and challenging Israel every morning, every evening. And so David runs to the supplies. And then verse 23, as he gets there, notice he was talking with them, David was. And behold, the champion, the Philistine from Gath, named Goliath, was coming up from the army. Remember, coming over on their sidelines. That's what the enemy does. Give him a piece of ground. Guess what he does? He'll start taking ground. Can't mess with him. Don't mess with him a bit. You got to kill him. Come up from the army of the Philistines, and he spoke these words to David. And David heard them. He's appalled. Can't believe it. Doesn't believe what's going on. David had been living essentially alone. I don't know if you know what it means to be a shepherd, but a shepherd means you're lonely. You don't get off at 5. Remember when Jesus was born, the angels went and found the shepherds where? At the local pub, you know, hanging out after work, right? No, where were they? They were in the fields watching the sheep. Why? Because that's when bad stuff happens in the night, is it not? And so you don't get off when it gets dark. You don't ever get off. And so David, we don't know how long he's been a shepherd, but as long as he's been a shepherd, he's basically been by himself. His brothers don't want anything to do with it, and he's been out there because he's the youngest one. And what has he been doing with his time? Well, apparently throwing rocks at stuff. That's going to be apparent. But also most evident is the fact that he's been spending time with the Lord. He's going to show up with a totally different attitude than the rest of these guys. Every last man of Israel, including Saul, the leader, does not see what David sees. Does not understand what David understands. Why? Because David is special? No, because he's been doing special stuff. Whatever they have been doing is not what David's been doing. And David's been doing something altogether different. And people say, well, you don't know how David's been spending his life. Oh, yeah, I do. I can prove it. We'll see. David's been spending his time coming to know God. And so we know that because of his reaction. We know that because of his experience. We know that because of how he reacts to what Saul says. So here's Saul's challenge. And then he says down there in verse 26, take a look. And David spoke to the men who were standing by him, saying, what will be done to this man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? He's incredulous. He's blown away. Why aren't you dudes doing something? What are you doing? These are his heroes, by the way. His brothers. Saul, king of Israel. Men of Israel. I mean, these are tough guys. These are battle-hardened individuals, and they're running scared as rabbits. He's absolutely blown away by it. He can't believe it. But he sees something differently than they see. They see a personal threat, right? They see physical death coming to them. What does David see? He sees a defiance of God. He sees a theological issue. Why? Because he's been doing something different than they have. He sees something different than they have because he's been living differently than they have. And that's the point I want to make to you this morning. Why is David different? Because David was different. He was not like them. He didn't do what they did. What was he doing in the fields? Well, a lot of stuff, throwing rocks and stuff, and I'm telling you, he was spending time with God. We know that because of the evidence. We know it because of the evidence. You want to be like David? Listen to me. Then be like David. You want to be like David? You got to be like David. You got to do what he did. You want to be who he was? Then you got to do what he did. It's just the way it works. Public arena is ever the proving ground of private devotion. I said, tell me who you are in private, I'll tell you who you are publicly. Sorry, that's the way it is. You don't like, you're a bad person when you're by yourself? Well, guess what? We're going to know about you before long. You want to see God work on your life powerfully when you're facing giants? Then you've got to win the battle before you ever face the giant. That's what David did. That's what David did. Why aren't you doing something? When I grew up in East Texas in the woods, and my brother and I, wait, I need to take that off the screen. It's a bit distracting. My face up there is just so nasty. And we caught everything that moved. I mean, we would catch fish and snakes and alligators, and we did all kinds of stuff. And we especially liked snakes. East Texas is full of snakes, and we would catch them. And we knew the difference between the poisonous ones and the not, which was a good thing, and the non-poisonous ones. And one summer, I don't remember what was going on, but we had been out in the woods messing around, and we caught a snake. And the snake had bitten my brother, Brian. And we came into the house, and it was time to eat lunch, and my mother had said it was a non-poisonous snake. I mean, we knew which ones were which. And my mother said, "Where have y'all been? It's time to eat, get cleaned up." And I said something to the effect of, "We caught a snake and it bit Brian." And she says, "Okay, well, you know, I don't want those in the house. Go outside and, you know, get your stuff ready and come back in and eat." What I didn't know, what we didn't know, was that there was a man in the house working, doing some construction. We had some different carpentry work to be done. He was not within eyeshot, but he was definitely within earshot of the conversation. My mother said that as soon as we left the room and went outside, she hears a voice coming from the other room saying, "Lady, aren't you going to do something? I mean, your son just said he got bit. Aren't you going to do something?" Sort of in my mind when I see David here, he's kind of reacting the same way. What are you guys doing? Can't you see what's happening? Why haven't you done something? Why are you, you are my heroes. Why aren't you carrying this out? Well, David is a spectacular individual. And he's been doing things alone that no one else had. And notice, he, because of his conversation, because he says he's going to fight Goliath, he gets called in before Saul. Look at verse 31. It says, "When the words of David that David spoke were heard, they told them to Saul, and he sent for him. And David said to Saul, 'Let no man's heart fail on account of him,'" that is Goliath, "'your servant will go and fight this Philistine.'" He's just a kid. Saul thinks he's stupid. Probably everybody else did. But David knew exactly what he was doing. Why? Because he had not been doing what everybody else had. David was different because David was different. He decided to be different. Saul said to David, "You are not able to go against this Philistine to fight him, for you are but a youth, and while he has been a warrior from his youth." And David said to Saul, "Your servant was tending his father's sheep." This is what he's been occupying himself with for a couple of years. "And when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb from the flock, I went out after him." Would you have done that? Not me, man. "And attacked him," he says. He jumps on these animals and rescued it from his mouth, he says. "And when he arose against me, I seized him by his beard and I struck him and killed him. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, since he has taught of the armies of the living God." And David said, "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." And Saul said to David, "Go and may the Lord be with you." What else can you say to that? What else can you say? Now, first of all, he makes some statements here that I don't want us to pass over. Because he says some statements about some wild animals and his dealings with them that, for me, it blows me away. I don't know what you know about animals, but I will tell you this. Pound for pound, animals outclass us significantly. Far superior to any human being. And all you have to do is mess with one to figure that out. As an example, try when you go home today, take your cat and try to stuff it in a bucket. Give it a shot. I would suggest a leather glove about this long. It's going to be tough. Little 5-pound cat. Take an 80-pound dog for a walk. An 80-pound human, how big is that? That's a small human being, isn't it, if it's an adult? He or she. An 80-pound dog is a big dog, isn't it? Take an 80-pound dog, put it on the end of a leash, and take it out where there's cats and other dogs, and watch what happens. Yeah, you're going to go for a walk, aren't you? You really are. I've got one of those. She's old, but I'm telling you, she's tough to walk. She really is. Because pound for pound, they are. Go out and go fishing and catch a 50-pound fish. Oh, you would love to do that, right? You're thinking, golly, that's what I told my wife I wanted to do, and the preacher's up there preaching about it. 50-pound fish will kill you, wear you, especially if you got light line. I caught a shark on heavy line, big shark about my size, and 15 minutes in the fight, I was done. I mean, I was just like, cut the line. I don't want this thing. And it was another 30 minutes before I got it in the boat, and I was ready for the boat. Let's just go home. I'm done. I got to go to the hospital as soon as I get back. I'm so wore out. The thing was my size. But animals, pound for pound, are far superior to us. So I want you to hear what David is saying here. He's not messing with dogs or cats or even sharks. He's by himself in the wilderness. A lion or a bear comes and takes one of his father's sheep, who he would have to reckon with. So what happened to my sheep? Well, a lion took it. Well, what'd you do about it? Well, David says, I went out after it. He catching the thing by the beard, knocking it in the head with a stick. That's the way he works. That's not to be passed over. That's significant. That, I would suggest to you, in my opinion, is bigger than Goliath, just because of my experience with animals. But anyway, we'll not go there. But just simply say this. David was, nobody knew who he was, but they're about to find out, weren't they? As far as they were concerned, he was just nothing but talk. I mean, who is the man? That's, what can you say? Saul says to him, go and Lord, the Lord bless you. I mean, what can you say to that? I killed a lion and a bear with my hands. What can you say to that? I think he's a liar and I think he's a nut and I'm about to watch him get killed. That's what he was thinking, I'd be willing to bet. But he's about to find out differently. About to be put to the test, the education that David had been receiving in the wilderness by himself. What had David been doing with himself? Well, I can tell you one thing he'd been doing with himself. He'd been spending time with God. Time with the Lord. Critical, crucial time. Learning to love Him. Learning to worship. Meditating on His Word. You say, well, you can't know that from the Scriptures. Oh, yes, I can. Look at verse 41. Look at how this young man reacts as opposed to all other people there, including Saul, the anointed. When the Philistine came and approached David, David goes out and goes out in the field, grabs himself five stones, and takes off. With a shield bearer in front, the Philistine comes. And when the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth and ruddy with handsome appearance. And the Philistine said to David, am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? Remember, like I said, he just carries a stick, kills lions with that thing. And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine also said to David, come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the sky, the beasts of the field. David said to the Philistine, you come to me with sword, spear, and javelin. Here's the statement where we know David's different than everybody else. But I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have taunted. See, David's not interested in David. Saul and all his men are interested in themselves because they're not going to get themselves toasted out there. David doesn't care about David. He cares strictly about God. He's learned something greatly in the wilderness, hasn't he? This day, verse 46, the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I will strike you down and remove your head from you, and I will give the dead bodies of the armies of the Philistines this day to the birds of the sky and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and that all this assembly may know that the Lord does not deliver by sword or by spear. For the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. Then it happened when the Philistine rose and drew near to David to meet him, that David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine. David put his hand in the bag, took from it a stone and slung it, struck the Philistine in the forehead, and the stone sank into his forehead so that he fell on his face to the ground. And thus David prevailed over the Philistine. With a sling and a stone, he struck the Philistine and killed him, and there was no sword in David's hand. Absolutely amazing. Gives me chills when I consider the power of this young man and what he knew, what he could see. You're not born that way. You don't just happen to wake up one day and say, oh, the reality of God. No. What he'd been doing in the wilderness? Spending time with God. He demonstrates it. Like I said, the public arena is ever the proving ground of private devotion. How was David's private devotion? Really good. Really good. We're all facing Goliaths in our lives. We are. You want to defeat them? You have to do it with David's way. David defeated Goliath before he ever got there. David defeated Goliath in his private devotional life. It will ever be that way for you and us. It will ever be that way. You want to wait till you get up there and cash a big check against the spiritual bank account that you haven't been contributing to, and guess what's going to happen to that check? It's going to bounce, and you're going to fall on your face. Goliath is not to be underestimated. He's beat up bigger and meaner people than you. So make sure that you've defeated him before you ever get there. The only way you can defeat Goliath is before you ever get there. We come to this story of David, and we learn to defeat giants, which is what we should do. I mean, that's what this story is about. But we come to this story, and we come away with lessons on faith, as we should, on bravery, on confidence, on vision. We're going to talk about that next week. We're going to talk about all these things next week. We come away with all these things, but I'm telling you, all those things are for naught If we don't have the devotional life of David, you can learn all these lessons about faith and bravery and confidence and knowledge of God, but it's for absolutely nothing if you don't have a devotional life that David had. You want to be like David? Then be like David. Have you ever bought a computer? I just bought one. I was telling somebody earlier that I'm leaving the PC. I'm going to the dark side. I'm going all the way with Apple. And I know, forgive me. But next Sunday, hopefully, there'll be an Apple sitting there, and it won't be glitching like this one. Bought a new computer, and it has loaded into it hundreds of dollars of software, but it's all trial versions. You realize those trial versions are actually the full versions, but you have to have a key to get to the rest of them, don't you? And it's when you use up the 30 days or whatever it is they give you for the trial version, and it's not the full version either. It's just partial. You get to do some of the things, but just a teaser to get you to want them, and then you've got to pay the money. And all they do is give you this little numbered lettered key, and you type it in there, and it opens up what's already on your computer. I mean, you mean to tell me I already have hundreds of dollars of software that I can't get into unless you give me a key? Yeah, that's exactly right. You have to pay the price, don't you? You realize it's the same true with the Christian life. When you're born again, you're loaded up with spiritual software. All of us have the same software. The Spirit of God, the presence of God, the fullness of God, the full Trinity comes live. He says, I come to live inside of you, and I will never leave you. That's all been downloaded in, but it's sort of like a trial version because you still have, for the most part, at least in your thinking, even though you're born again, you're spiritually completely new, you still think like a lost person, don't you? And so you operate in these areas, but only in trial versions. And you never can open them. You will never open them, listen, until you pay the price. And the price is devotion. The price is time with God. Like I said, you want to be like David? You've got to be like David. There's no shortcuts. There's no end runs. And don't wait till the battle is joined before you say, God help me. You better have been saying, God help me, way before that. God rescued me. God changed me. God made me into the person that you want me to be. All that's got to be said before you ever hit the battleground, before anything's tough. You better pray that prayer many, many times. If you have, then you'll be like David. See, we go away and we do a lot of things with our lives. David went away, and what did he do? Well, we know what he did. He devoted himself to the Lord, had no clue that this was coming in his life. Had no clue that he would ever be anything other than just a little weird shepherd in the middle of a desert with a few sheep. And so he just resigned himself to that and said, God, where are you? God, I give myself to you. God, let me know you. The God of Israel who's done all these things, the stories I've heard and all the things, I want to know you. Teach me how to throw a rock. Help me fight this bear. Help me fight this lion. That was all he ever saw, all he ever cared about. And then until one day God says, I'm going to show what you really are to the rest of the world. You know, like I said, the public arena is ever the proving ground of private devotion. You want to be a certain person in public? Make sure you're that same person when you're private. Make sure that you are. We give a lot of credit to David, and it's undeserved, and it's unasked for. David doesn't take any credit in this story. David gives all the credit to God. It's all about God. It's not about David. It was not about God, not about David. It was about God. God in David's life. God in David's devotional life. That's what made all the difference. I want to challenge you today. Take a challenge. Spend time with God. You do a lot of things. You dedicate a lot of time to a lot of things, don't you? How about this? How about a whole day with God? A whole day. You, a Bible, a notepad, you should expect that he's going to say some things to you. Maybe some things you don't like. For prayer request, some kind of way to worship him, an iPad or something like that. No media otherwise, just time alone with God. You cannot be bigger than who you are publicly than who you are privately. So order your private life. Spend time with him, not just one day. Spend time every day with him. I ask you would bow your heads and close your eyes with me. You want to be like David? I know I do. I want to be just like him. David's not our model, ultimately Jesus Christ is, but David was a guy who knew the Lord. When the tough times came and when he had to cash a check against a spiritual bank account, it didn't bounce. And I pray that would be the same for us today. Heavenly Father, Lord, I pray that would be the same for us. that who we want to be publicly would be matched by who we are indeed already ongoing privately. That our time with you, our heart for you, we wouldn't care what anyone thinks about us. We would be all by ourselves. We don't care whatever happens with us. We just simply want to be with you. We just simply want to love you. Lord, I pray that that attitude, that spirit would settle on us today. Lord, we see David and we're amazed at his faith, his ability, his skill. And he was the least amazed. He just simply knew you and did what he knew in his heart he should do. And it turned out wonderful. Lord, help us as we face the giants in our lives to realize that those giants are defeated before we ever get there, before the battle's ever joined. Those battles are won and lost in our private life. Thank you, Lord, for speaking to us through this story. We praise you, God. Move in our hearts now, we pray, in Jesus' name. Amen. I ask you, please stand with me this